From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's no secret that there's some creepy, crawly stuff happening in our bodies. Microbes, trillions of cells, live underneath our skin, forming our microbiome. They're all over our body, but most of them live down in our gut. Scientists have been intrigued by this gut bacteria for some time now, but lately, excitement is picking up steam with research into how it could play a role in anxiety, depression, how we feel, think, and more. This hour on Point, digging into new research on the microbiome. You can join us on air or online. What's your gut reaction here? Are you intrigued? Do you believe it? The bacteria in your gut could affect your brain? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York City is Peter Andre Smith. He often writes about microbes and our relationship to them. His new piece from the New York Times Magazine currently is the most emailed article on the New York Times website. It's called "Can the Bacteria in Your Gut Explain Your Mood?" You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So this is incredibly interesting research in peer-reviewed journals that you've been studying and writing about. What's new here about the connection between our brains and the microbes in our gut?
I think what's new is that it's being given a kind of credibility that it's never had. I mean, people have thought this previously, but this has just been given a lot more attention, and incredible scientists are saying, you know, psychiatric researchers say, you know, there is some sort of influence. These microbes exert some sort of they shape brain function and behavior.
So different bacteria in the gut actually produce changes in the brain that affects behavior. Is that the bottom line?
Yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, microbes are making neurochemicals. They're also making these smaller molecules called metabolites, and those sort of interface with the brain. The brain can sort of send the gut messages, but the brain can also sort of receive messages from those microbes.
Mm. So give us a working definition of microbiome. I sort of described it a little bit, but from your perspective and ongoing research and understanding, give us an understanding or a definition of what that is.
Yeah, so the microbiome is basically the collection of all the genetic material from these organisms, and they live in our intestine and on our skin, and they're even finding them sort of in the brain itself, which is pretty exciting. But so the microbiome refers to all the genetic material. And it also sort of like a biome in ecological terms is like the home. So it's like the home for microbes.
So microbiome is sort of its own organ, essentially, in the body, not recognized often, but a microbiome is a makeup of a sort of organ within our body itself.
Yeah, and people like Rob Knight are saying, you know, this is a, you know, it's a 2 to 6 pound organ, and some people are saying, you know, it has almost as much influence as the brain itself. But I think that might be going a step too far, but it's certainly this underappreciated organ.
Hmm. In your piece in the New York Times Magazine, you talk with a scientist who's using fecal transplants to this end. Without getting too graphic, how does that work? Tell us about that.
So yeah, basically fecal microbiota transplants, or FMTs as they're called, basically involve taking a healthy donor's feces and straining it and making sure there are no pathogens, and then essentially transplanting that into a diseased person's intestine.
And then what?
In one case, so there's one pathogenic infection called C. difficile, and fecal transplants are incredibly successful, and they're basically the only known treatment at this point for that disease. But so I initially came to this story because I went to a stool bank where they're essentially storing healthy human feces, and you know, giving it out like a medicine. And I guess in the process of reporting the story, I came across some scientists that were saying, well, are there any psychiatric risks to this process? And I thought, well, that's really intriguing. I mean, if they do sort of exert some sort of influence on the brain, is there a risk here? So that's sort of how I came onto the story.
Is there a risk?
I think nobody really knows. I mean, some people say that there is essentially no I mean, in these patients, we're not seeing, you know, radical shifts, but all the animal models, and most of this, I guess another thing to emphasize is most of this research is in animal models, and they're essentially doing fecal transplants with mice. And in that case, they can see, you know, you can sort of make a timid mouse chicken or a chicken mouse brave, so to speak. Mm.
So the behavior actually changes. Here's an online testimonial from January of this year. Jeff Curtis, he had a fecal transplant to help with his ulcerative colitis. Here he is speaking about the success of his operation.
My improvement has been about 80 to 90%. The really debilitating symptoms have been completely alleviated because of fecal transplants, and that's why I'm confident enough to share my story and encourage others to try this.
So you can actually change behavior. Peter, you say that one chicken who's not anxious will be, or the other way around, or depression, or whatever the case may be. How far does this extend?
I think nobody really knows, and I don't think people shouldn't be running out, you know, going in for transplants to cure psychiatric illness at this point. I don't think anybody's suggesting that, but it's certainly a really promising area of research, and we're just at the beginning of trying to understand that. And when you look at the studies in mice and now with primates, it's really, you know, it seems like there is, if you replace your microbiota, you can certainly change brain function and behavior.
Mm. Let me bring in another voice here from Monterey, California, Rob Knight, biologist and professor of pediatrics and computer science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the Microbiome Initiative. He's co-founder of the American Gut Project and the Earth Microbiome Project, author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Rob Knight, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your work with microbiome. How does bacteria in our gut, from a scientific perspective, affect our brain?
Well, from a scientific perspective, as Peter mentioned, we know a lot more about that if you're a mouse than if you're a human. So what we know for sure in mice is that they produce neurotransmitters, they produce metabolites, so chemicals that get into your bloodstream, and can affect the activity of every cell in your body. They also signal to your brain through a nerve called the vagus nerve that runs directly from your gut to your brain. They also alter your inflammatory state, and so they can signal to your brain through your immune system. And so there's a lot of different ways that they can have different effects. What we're trying to figure out is which of those biological mechanisms are actually important in humans.
Mm. And the progress is remarkable. 15 years ago, the idea that you could sequence DNA was just being explored, and now we're talking about so many diseases linked to microbiome, from MS to anxiety, depression, even memory and learning, right?
Absolutely. And in large part, the reason we know so much is the decline in the cost of DNA sequencing. So it's literally about a million times cheaper to sequence DNA than it was 15 years ago when the human genome was announced complete. And so as a result, it's just possible to look at a lot more kinds of DNA from all those bacteria in the gut, where you have as many as 2 to 20 million genes compared to our 20,000 human genes. And so there's a lot more DNA to sequence. And so cheaper costs mean we can look at it in more people, and we can start to understand all that complexity.
So gut microbes essentially communicate with the nervous system using some of the same neurochemicals that relay messages within the brain. Is that right?
Correct. So 80 to 90% of your serotonin is in your gut, not in your brain.
80 to 90% of serotonin is in your gut, not your brain. And so certain bacteria, certain microbes, certain microbiome more likely to be associated with, for example, depressive patients.
That's certainly true if your patient is a mouse. The evidence in humans is weaker at this point, but suggestive. And there's a lot of effort going into trying to figure that out in humans at the moment. One important consideration is if you look at some people who are healthy and some who are depressed, you don't know, and you find their microbes are different, you don't know whether that difference is the cause or an effect of the depression, right? So maybe the depression changes your behavior, you do something differently, that changes your microbes. So understanding causality using animal models and also using longitudinal studies where you try to enroll people before they're sick and then you see what changes first, the microbes or the disease, those are both really important for unraveling some of these complex patterns.
You run the American Gut Project. Tell us what that is, Rob Knight.
Well, the American Gut Project really exploits the decline in cost of DNA sequencing to take the techniques we developed during the Human Microbiome Project, $173 million NIH-funded initiative that defines a healthy baseline, and it opens it up to anyone. So basically the goal is to make it possible for anyone who contributes to the project at a relatively nominal level to be able to have their microbiome sequenced and to see that in the context of other people across the United States and now across the world who are living different lifestyles, are of different ages, have different conditions and so forth. And so you can really start to get an understanding of where you fit personally into this larger microbial picture.
And look at the differences between individual gut bacteria based on what they live, based on their lifestyles, that sort of thing.
Yeah, precisely. And it's full of surprises. I mean, the things that come up as important are often things that nobody really expected.
Like?
So, for example, one of the most important factors is how many different kinds of plants you eat every week, and that's a lot more important, at least in the data we've seen, than whether or not you eat meat. We can also link your microbes to things like how many hours sleep you get at night, how much you exercise, whether you do that exercise indoors or outdoors, what season you collect the sample in, whether you have pets, and all kinds of things that you might not have thought would be driving.
Oh my goodness, so much to get to, and we will after this break. We're talking about the bacteria that inhabits our bodies, our microbiome, and how it interacts with the rest of us. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the emerging and growing research into the microbiome this hour. Could it cause depression, anxiety, and more? We're speaking this hour with Peter Andre Smith. His new piece from the New York Times Magazine is called "Can the Bacteria in Your Gut Explain Your Mood?" You can link to it on our website, onpointradio.org. Also with me, Rob Knight, biologist and professor of pediatrics and computer science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the Microbiome Initiative. He's co-founder of the American Gut Project and the Earth Microbiome Project, author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Here's some sound from an informational video for the American Gut Project. Dr. Jack Gilbert, a colleague of our guest here, Rob Knight, talks about the process of collecting information on the microbiome.
We take the sample, we extract DNA from it, we take that DNA, we amplify particular genes which tell us what microorganisms are there and what do they do, and then we place those that genetic information into a sequencing machine which translates the little pieces of liquid into information, the A's, G's, T's and C's of the genetic code, which help us to translate that information into what kinds of microorganisms do you have there, what's their relative abundance, and what's their functional potential, i.e. what roles do they play in the community that lives inside you.
So, Rob Knight, is this happening now? As I understand it, humans are receiving fecal transplants, right?
Yes, that's right. That's happening right now, and there's a lot of people walking around alive today who wouldn't be alive had they not received a fecal transplant.
So, give us an example of that.
So the vast majority of those are from Clostridium difficile associated disease. So this is a hospital acquired infection that kills about 14,000 people a year in the United States alone. Antibiotics are 30-40% effective, but fecal transplant is 95% effective.
Let's get a caller in here, John from Newport News, Virginia. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to share an experience that I have. I have a condition that's been undiagnosed so far, and it's been gastrointestinal, and I've had severe anxiety and depression. We started by trying to treat the anxiety and depression, and that was just by giving me pharmaceuticals to try and calm me down and things like that. But as my experience went on, the more we looked into using probiotics and eating healthier and things like that, and, you know, my stools became more regular and things like that, my anxiety and depression started to improve. So I just wanted to call in to tell people who are suffering from anxiety and depression to really look into how you eat and to look into taking probiotics because it can really help.
John, thank you. Before we send everybody out to get a probiotic, Rob Knight, talk about that. It's a hugely, it's a difficult industry, very unregulated to say the least.
Yes, it is a very difficult industry. And the story we just had is very interesting, and there are some examples some examples in mice with Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG and a few other specific probiotics that have had anxiolytic effects. So in other words, reducing the anxiety of mice. But as all the drug companies know, it's a lot easier to cure a mouse than it is to cure a person, and clinical trials have not yet been done in humans. One thing that's very important with probiotics is that there are many different strains of them, and they all do different things, just like there are many drugs, and they all do different things. So it's very likely that you need. It's very likely that if probiotics can have anxiolytic or antidepressant effects in humans, that it'll be specific probiotics, and that you'll need to pay careful attention to the strain of bacteria, and also potentially to other indications, like whether or not you have celiac or irritable bowel syndrome, both of which are often associated with depression.
So the trick is matching the strain of the probiotic with the symptom that you're experiencing.
Correct. And another huge problem is that because there's so little regulation of probiotics in the United States, whether what's on the label is what's actually in the bottle is another huge issue with many of the products that are on the market.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation from Culver City, California, Dr. Emeryn Meyer. He's a gastroenterologist and professor in the Department of Medicine, Psychiatry, and Physiology at the University of California, Los Angeles, director of the UCLA Gale and Gerald Oppenheimer Family Center for Neurobiology and Stress, co-director of CURE, Digestive Diseases Research Center. Dr. Meyer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Good to be on the show.
Great to have you. You've done some really interesting work involving MRIs and the imaging of people's brains as it relates to the microbiome. Tell us about your research.
Some years ago, we were approached by one of the food companies, dairy companies, if we were interested in participating in studies related to probiotics. And I have to say, at the time, I was very skeptical about this kind of research. I did not really think this was something worthwhile pursuing. But make a long story short, we did a study, really well-designed study, placebo-controlled, two placebo groups in healthy women. So this was a proof of principle, proof of concept study, where we essentially wanted to see, is a human correlate to the studies, to the intriguing studies that have been done in rodent models, in mice. And so one of the groups of subjects got a probiotic cocktail, commercially available. Another group got a non-fermented milk product, indistinguishable in taste and texture from the probiotic product, and one group did not get any therapy. So we found that after 4 weeks of ingestion of this product, there was a change in the brain in response to a task that we call an emotion recognition task, where subjects are being asked to match facial expressions that they briefly see between, they essentially see three faces and have to match the two that have the same emotional expression. And while doing this validated task, we monitored the brain activity and found that an entire network was engaged with that task involving multiple brain regions, so not just the emotional system that we initially had hypothesized. And we found a very clear difference of how the regions in that brain network that was engaged were connected with each other.
So the microbes in your gut activated different areas in your brain based on the MRI studies.
The main thing was that they caused a difference in the way the brain regions were connected. So we saw the same brain regions, but the way they were connected. And they were less connected in this network in the probiotic group compared to the non-fermented milk product group, and in the opposite direction in the no treatment group. So a pretty intriguing finding. It was often interpreted in the lay press that this was an anxiolytic effect. We can't really say that because this task does not induce an emotion. But it's a fairly pronounced basic reflex in the brain by which you assess the emotional valence of a situation.
So, and what are the pathways that get the microbes from the gut to the brain? Is it nerve pathways? Is it bloodstream? Is it hormonal pathways? Or some sort of interaction between all three?
Well, as was mentioned earlier, there's several parallel communication channels that go from the gut to the brain, and also channels that go from the brain back to the gut. So it's really a very complex bidirectional system. What we hypothesize, sort of based on the animal models, was that the most plausible pathway is probably through the vagus nerve, and there's a particular system. There are cells in the gut that contain the serotonin. They're synaptically connected to the vagus, so they're essentially part of the brain. And they have receptors for various molecules that these microbes produce. So the most plausible, even though not proven in humans nor in animals, the most plausible pathway is that these microbes produce chemicals to act on these serotonin-containing cells. This changes basically the signal that gets out from the vagus to the brain and directly into the limbic system of the brain. Mm.
Rob Knight, it's not just mood and emotions. The bacterial makeup of the intestines may also determine whether people lose weight or gain weight, right? How so?
Yeah, that's correct. So I can predict with 90% accuracy based on your microbes whether you're lean or obese. You might think that that's a cool trick, but there's easier ways to tell if you're fat. But I can only do that particular prediction task with 58% accuracy based on your human genes versus 90% accuracy based on your microbial genes. And there was a French study that came out a couple of years ago where they were able to show that they could predict who was going to lose weight on a weight loss diet that they were trying out, depending on the microbial community beforehand. So that holds open the prospect that you might be able to figure out whether a diet or an exercise program or a combination of both was actually going to work for you before you started it based on your microbes.
Mm. Let's get a call in here. Chris from Casadega, New York. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
What a great show. Always a good show. Fascinating and more timely than ever for myself. Exactly a year ago, I wound up in the hospital because I had a nail in my foot. My nervous system has been compromised as far as feeling down in my feet is concerned. So I didn't even realize it for about a week that there was this small carpet nail buried in my foot.
And so you got sick and you had to go to the hospital. Did they give you antibiotics?
Oh, they gave me, I got sepsis. And because they could not find out what the different offending bacteria were in my body, they shotgunned it with antibiotics. 51 different intravenous antibiotics over a 4-day period. Mm. So they also gave me a commercial prescription probiotic pill to take. But it wiped out my entire native biome, and I'm somebody who really has worked through the years to establish a good holistic system. And
you're wondering how to get it back, huh? How do you restore your microbiome if it's been wiped out? Yeah.
They ended up putting me on this clindamycin when another bacteria, after I left the hospital, took residence in my foot.
Let's turn to the experts, Chris. Rob Knight, can you restore microbiome that's been devastated by a treatment such as Chris's hand here, 51 intravenous antibiotics?
That's exactly the kind of thing we're working on at the moment. So fecal transplant holds a lot of promise, but the way it's regulated at the moment, you're not allowed to do it for anything except C. diff infection. The good news about commercial probiotics is that mostly what they're doing is not establishing themselves in the gut, but they're providing a favorable environment for the bacteria that normally in your gut to recolonize. So you can almost think of them more as being like mulch, where you're putting them down, and then the right kinds of seeds that you're exposed to in the environment from other people's bacteria are going to regrow in that more favorable condition.
Let's see, Dr. Meyer, I'm reading a statistic here in the Financial Times. The average American child goes through 17 courses of antibiotics in their childhood. Talk about the impact of antibiotics on the gut and what it's doing to our microbiome.
This question is easier to answer in terms of one area that or one consequence, one negative consequence of that kind of treatment, namely on obesity and metabolic syndrome. So Marty Blaser at NYU has written a beautiful book on this, really comprehensive, implicating that this dramatic increase in early life exposure to microbes, particularly at an age when the microbiome is still under construction, the first 3 years of life, is likely to have a long-lasting, possibly permanent effect on the diversity of the gut microbiome and consequences on the metabolites, body weight, ingestive behavior, and so forth. We know less about this in terms of what effects it has on diseases, brain diseases that have seen a dramatic increase in the last couple of decades. Autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit disorder. Anytime you see a disease that has, based on epidemiology, so this dramatic increase, just like obesity, you think there may be a common underlying cause. And antibiotics early in life could be such a cause. We don't know this for sure, but I think it's a very plausible explanation.
Let's go to Hartsville, South Carolina. Joan is on the line. Hi, Joan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Great show. I just got into it a few minutes ago. I'm a person who has suffered from a very painful illness called fibromyalgia. I have pain in my muscles and connective tissue. I also have depression with that. I was perfectly healthy until about 2 years after I had my son. I was 35. And I've... You know, getting treated for it, at least in this country, is kind of like putting Band-Aids on it. And I finally got in with a really, really good doctor, and he did lots of tests. And
have you heard of the fecal transplants that we've been discussing here, Joan?
No, I hadn't. And one of the things that I know, lots of fibromyalgics have irritable bowel syndrome. And I'm lucky I don't have that, but... when I worked with this one doctor, he had put me on probiotics. And
did it help?
I don't know, because the problem is I wasn't insured at the time, and it got to be so expensive that I had to stop the treatment.
Joan, I'm coming up on a break here, and I've got to cut you off. I'm very sorry, but I do want to just wrap this up here, Rob Knight, by saying IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and depression seem to go hand in hand as I read from the research here.
Yes, that's right.
And so what do you make of that? What's the cause?
Emmerin could possibly answer that better than I could. My understanding is that the cause is not currently known, although there are some probiotics that are effective for some forms of IBS. So it's a very exciting area, especially seeing whether those probiotics also treat the depression that's associated.
Dr. Meyer?
I mean, these are very complex diseases, and one unique thing is that fibromyalgia, IBS, and other chronic pain conditions often co-occur together in the same patient. I think even though we don't know the exact mechanisms, I think it's an intriguing possibility that all these start in the gut with a dysbiotic state and gradually manifest in different systems like your muscles, your joints, the GI tract, the urinary system. So I think we're still a ways away from knowing that for sure, but I think it's a very exciting avenue to go.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the emerging research surrounding the microbiome, how it can change our mood and our behavior. We're speaking this hour with Peter Andre Smith. His new piece from the New York Times Magazine is called Can the Bacteria in Your Gut Explain Your Mood? Rob Knight, biologist and professor of pediatrics and computer science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the Microbiome Initiative, and Dr. Emerin Meyer, gastroenterologist and professor in the Department of Medicine, Psychiatry, and Physiology at UCLA. Here's some sound. Chandris Lawton Cuevas contracted C. diff, which is a bacteria that releases toxins and attacks the lining of the intestines after she gave birth to her son. She told news station WBAL that she only started feeling healthy after having a fecal transplant.
I was willing to try anything to try to have a normal life. And ultimately it worked for me because I got to keep my colon and I have a normal way of life.
And here's the doctor who performed that fecal transplant, Dr. Sanjay Jagatha. He says this is an important option for patients.
This, to me, has transformed a really big problem. It is so gratifying to do this. It actually is one of the most gratifying things that I do because I make such a huge impact in someone's life in a matter of days.
So my guests this hour, Dr. Emerin Meyer, Rob Knight, Peter Andre Smith. Let's see, Dr. Meyer, are there downsides to fecal replacement?
Well, Rob mentioned that before that, if you look at the animal experiments where it's fairly easy to transplant a behavioral trait like anxiety from one mouse to another just by fecal transplant. If even part of this were applicable to humans, then we would have to be quite concerned about transplanting undesirable behaviors into people that get a fecal transplant without even knowing it. So this could be, if somebody has a family history of schizophrenia or depression, wouldn't even have to have the disease him or herself. So there is a risk. There's one example where a woman got a fecal transplant, I believe, for C. diff treatment, and she became obese. This was one example. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we don't know if that happens more frequently, but it's certainly something, I think, to keep in mind.
Mm. Rob Knight, do you see that, fecal transplants transplanting undesirable behaviors?
It does have that potential based on the mouse work, and the AGA, the American Gastroenterological Association, for that reason is very excited about the possibility of setting up a registry so that we can track people who have fecal transplants and understand what the long-term outcomes are. Now, it's important to remember that a lot of the same concerns were expressed about things like organ transplants and blood transfusions and so forth, which have turned out to be extremely valuable. But in the same way, it might be necessary to more precisely match up particular donors to particular recipients, and that research is only just beginning at the moment.
Here's Nancy in Canton, Ohio. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for this wonderful show. I'm so excited to hear this. My daughter is 36. She has debilitating gastrointestinal problems, has had them since she was 8 years old. She has been test-probed, MRI'd, CAT scan. She's had more colonoscopies than I have. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath.
That's okay.
She also has bipolar disorder. Mm. Western medicine has found nothing for her except they have diagnosed her with IBS. Severe IBS, and also Crohn's disease. She's very meticulous about her diet. She is eating a gluten-free diet. She makes her own kombucha. She spends lots of money on cranberry supplements and probiotics and this and that and the other thing. She cannot live a normal life. Mm. The only job she can have is one that will tolerate the fact that she has debilitating gastrointestinal problems.
And so, Nancy, would she consider some of the treatments we're talking about here? Is this you sort of a last resort? Sounds like you've been through everything
else. Yes, she has an appointment with a gastroenterologist, which she couldn't have when she didn't have health insurance, but now she does. Mm. And my question is the gastroenterologist going to know about this? Mm.
Nancy, thank you. Rob Knight, how widespread are these treatments?
Well, not widespread at the moment, but increasingly rapidly. Like, there's a huge amount of interest among gastroenterologists, and AGA through the Microbiome Center there, we're also trying to provide resources to educate physicians and educate patients about some of the exciting possibilities here, but also about the risks.
And Dr. Meyer, you must meet people like Nancy and her daughter who have exhausted every other medical option, right? They're essentially desperate when they come to you.
Yes, absolutely. I've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of patients like Nancy's daughter. The problem right now is that, so we know that the brain and the gut are intricately connected in both directions. We don't know if the GI symptoms influence the brain, including the microbiota, influence the brain to play a role in these brain diseases, symptoms, or if it's the other way around, that the output from the brain in a brain that has depression, anxiety, changes the environment of the gut microbiota in a way that they become not optimal and cause the GI symptoms. So unfortunately, at this point, it's more art than science for patients with those severe symptoms. There's no fecal transplant is not as efficient or has not even been proven to be effective as it is in C. diff. So it's usually what I do is try various treatment strategies and individualize it for a given patient. Mm. But unfortunately, it's not as clear-cut as it is in C. diff, where we have a dramatic effect of a fecal transplant.
Rob Knight, tell us about your work with the Earth Microbiome Project and what we've learned about how microbiomes are affected by the environment we're actually in.
Sure. So very briefly, the Earth Microbiome Project is an effort to take these techniques that we've developed to study our bodies and apply them to the whole planet. So understanding how the oceans, the soils, the lakes, even the air change in microbiology over time and over space. What we're learning is that we have this tremendous connection between the human microbiome and the environment, not only the outdoor environment, so connections to microbes from healthy soils, for example, are turning out to be increasingly important, but also the built environment that we spend most of our time in. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation has really pioneered this with this Microbiology of the Built Environment program. And it's amazing because we've really sealed ourselves off from the natural environment in these buildings where we're effectively stewing in our own microbes most of the day. And historically, that's not at all what's happened. If you look at people who are living in more traditional dwellings, whether it's in South America or Africa, or even dwellings built in the United States more than the last 50 to 100 years ago, you see much more interconnection between the outdoor and the indoor microbiology, which may have important implications for things like asthma, allergies, other autoimmune disease is sort of skyrocketing at the moment. Mm.
Let's get Mark in here from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I was just listening, and I just wanted to call in. I'm a psychologist out of Montreal, and one of the things that I wanted to point out is when people have feelings, especially complex feelings towards people close to them, it can often generate anxiety. And that's what we see in clinical practice a lot of the time. That anxiety can be discharged in a number of different pathways. One is in striated muscle, and that you see in flight or flight responses. You also see anxiety getting discharged into smooth muscle, which means a lot of times when people have complex feelings that they have a difficult time tolerating, what happens is it actually goes to the gut, and people tend to have gastrointestinal issues.
So you're saying it works both ways?
Exactly. I would imagine things within the gut can affect mood, but what we see routinely and is well established through many studies is that anxiety that is getting discharged can also then affect the gut.
Mark, thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Meyer, would you respond to that?
Yeah, I would totally support this. Clearly, there's an extensive literature of how the stress system within the brain has very specific effects on all kinds of gut functions, from contractions, gastric emptying, secretion, secretion of all kinds of molecules. What's intriguing in the context of the gut microbiota, we also know that neurotransmitters released by the brain, by the autonomic nervous system, into the gut lumen, such as serotonin or norepinephrine, can act on receptors of the microbiota and change their behavior. So some of them, for example, norepinephrine can make them more aggressive and more virulent and make them attack our gut. So there's a myriad of mechanisms by which the brain, in an emotional state like anxiety, or probably also depression, can completely change the what I like to call the theater of mind in the gut, and cause all kinds of symptoms at the gut level.
Peter Andre Smith, jump back in here. In your reporting in the New York Times, you write of a bigger philosophical question as part of this discussion. And that is, if microbes are such a big part of our makeup in our gut and throughout our body, what does it mean to, I think your words were, what does it mean to actually be human? Talk about that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think we're at a real inflection point where we've sort of ignored these organisms that have been part of our part of what it means to be human. So, you know, I talked with Tom Insel, who's the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, and he was saying, you know, this really sort of changes our sense of self. And I think a lot of other scientists like Rob and Emmerin are both, you know, they say this has really transformed the way that we look at, you know, human life and how we think and how we learn and how we remember things has to do with not only the human component, but also with this sort of overlooked microbial component. Mm.
Give us an idea of the kind of projects that are being worked on right now. We've talked about fecal replacement and some other things here. What's the scientific community really excited about right now?
I think, so in talking with the National Institute of Mental Health, they have given out 4 grants. And Nancy Desmond, who really spearheaded that effort, so they're basically 4 different teams, and so they're looking at maternal transmission, so how a mother's microbes are sort of passed along to, in this case, infant mice, and saying how does that affect neurodevelopment later in life. And there's another team in North Carolina that's swabbing infants, and they're going to try to link that up with anxiety later in life. So is there some, with this, in the early phases of life where your brain is still developing, like what role do these microbes play? And I think that's become, I mean, we're really at an inflection point, and, you know, the research is still very new, but it's all very promising.
Here's Matthew in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, hello, Jane.
Hi.
Doctors. So I was just wondering, so with this new technology, obviously, with, you know, new research and stuff, there's people that are going to capitalize on that, and we're already doing fecal transplants. So how does someone, you know, with Dr. Oz and all the MD websites, protect themselves from guys that don't know what they're doing? How do we do our homework to make sure that this is something that we actually want to do?
Great question, Matthew. Thank you. Dr. Emmerin Meyer.
Yeah, this is a very important point, and I think it's very difficult for the consumer to differentiate between quackery on the website, commercial interests of you know, various food supplements, and legitimate information about the science and what's potentially useful, what's not harmful. So it makes it very difficult for the consumer. I would recommend to just go to reputable sites, not surf the web, and for all kinds of cures. And I should mention at this point, you know, there was a time, a very unfortunate time in psychiatry, early parts of the 19th century, where there was a boom of interest in microbial products for treating all kinds of mental illnesses, and it was a non-scientific approach at the time. I think we have to be very careful that this time around we're going to do it properly, and only use things and apply things that that have a scientific basis to them.
Because Rob Knight, the future of this is possibly big business, right?
Yes, I'd argue that even the present of this is very big business.
So where do you see the future then? Where do you see this going, Rob Knight?
Well, where we are right now is we're really at the sort of boiling willow bark phase, right, where we know there's something there, but we don't have highly active biological preparations. So what we're going to be seeing parallel to the development of drugs as medications is much more information about the biological mechanisms, much more information about the specificity, and much better ability to tell what microbes are going wrong in your particular body and what specific treatments are going to restore them to the balance that you need. Mm.
Dr. Emmerin Meyer, how do you expect to be able to use this research in the future?
Well, I think one of the most important things is, in addition to some of the groundbreaking, basic science that that Rob and others have been performing, I think we really need to validate how much of the findings in animals and in cells translate to human health and to human disease, what subtypes of patients, based on their fingerprinting of their gut microbiome, are susceptible or responsive to particular therapies. So I think the need for human studies, where we clearly identify how much of the incredibly exciting science actually applies and where we can make a difference, I think that's one of the key next steps.
Peter Andre Smith, your last word here. You've got the most emailed article on the New York Times website. This Can the Bacteria in Your Gut Explain Your Mood? Were you surprised by the reaction? What are you hearing from people, from your readers?
Yeah, I think people are curious about this, and I think there's a lot of people that have symptoms that modern medicine can't explain. They're really desperate for answers, and the cure is not around the corner, but this is a really promising new area of science that certainly deserves more attention. Bacteria aren't all bad, and it certainly seems like they can exert some sort of influence on brain function and behavior, and we're just at the beginning.
Peter Andre Smith, New York Times Magazine. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank
you. Rob Knight, biologist and professor of pediatrics and computer science at the University of California, San Diego. Appreciate your time, Rob Knight. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Dr. Emmerin Meyer, gastroenterologist, professor in the Department of Medicine, Psychiatry, and Physiology at UCLA. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jane.
Thank you, listeners. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.